When I first came up to Western North Carolina for any real length of time, I had quit my job and I was in my early to mid-30s, and I worked at the Nantahala Outdoor Center in the summer, but then in the fall, after it got too cold for that and the season shut down, I worked on a log cabin building crew where Peter Gott was he's a master builder, and we ended up cutting down white pine, actually going out, felling the trees, and then sending them off to be milled on two sides, and then working with them and building a log cabin so that it could sit through the winter. And we did it a lot we used chainsaws, but the rest were hand tools pretty much for the whole thing. So there was a lot going on, and I didn't know much of anything about it. I was just out there as the gopher. And Daryl was one of the head guys, and he did something for all of us on the crew. He made each one of us doctors. So, exactly. Each one of us were doctors, and every time something happened where he called us over, it was never a problem or we have something awful here. He would go, "Dr. McKinley, we have an opportunity here." Well, that did two things. One of the ones was just in the doctor. I mean, I knew I didn't know anything about it, but there was this encouragement. And the sense of it was an opportunity, there was the possibility to make it different. There was the possibility to make it right. So that was the key thing. Dr. McKinley, we have an opportunity here. And that has stuck with me ever since. How many of you here get the UU World magazine? Have you gotten this issue and, yeah, seen it? Well, the top headline reads, I don't know what you call it where it's above the title, but it says, "President resigns amid outcry over hiring practices." That's the president of the UUA has resigned. Okay. For those of you later who are going to tell me that my talk was too political, I didn't do that. I had nothing to do with that. I'm just reading what says right here. And then inside it explains what happened, and it really was white men, me, in positions of power, hiring another white man to put in a position of power when they had other choices, and people finally said, "That's enough," pretty much, and then called that into question. And as a result of that, the president actually is a person, identifies as a person of color in that he's Latino, President Peter Morales. But he was also male and in that position, and he had made some remarks that kind of made the controversy get bigger. But since then, two more people in high positions, the chief operating officer and then the head of the congregational life staff, have resigned. I guess you'd say they've resigned. So that's two more white guys. And the guy who was appointed into the job didn't take it, so that it left that position open. And of this last, and as you just heard, that's another part of the story, really. But this last week, the first executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association, Don Southworth, stepped down and will not be at the General Assembly. So just start thinking about that in a small organization, how much space has been created, and General Assembly is now happening in 10 days. That's the sort of the committee of the whole and the governing body and the chance for discussion. Well, so our first reading is from the three co-presidents that the board appointed, their interim co-presidents. They all identify as people of color, and they're people that you would recognize. But here is their letter, or one of their summary. They've written letters all along, but the title of this reading is Making This a Time of Opportunity. Exactly. Making this, rather than this, making this a time of opportunity and possibility. We write as the new interim co-presidents of the Unitarian Universalist Association appointed by the Board of Trustees to serve through General Assembly in June. As we write, we are just now embarking on this 10-week journey. We thank the Board of Trustees for the privilege of leadership we have been given. Each of us agreed to serve out of our own experience and commitment to Unitarian Universalism. The Reverend Sophia Betancourt previously served on the UUA staff as Director of Racial and Ethnic Concerns and is now a professor at Starr King School for the Ministry. The Reverend William G. Sinkford is a former president of the UUA and now senior minister at First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. Leon Spencer is professor emeritus at Georgia Southern University in Statesboro, Georgia, and a decades-long lay leader. Each of us claims an identity as a person of color. And then they say how they join, their leadership joins that of UUA moderator Jim Key and the Board of Trustees. And then they've even had an update to this in the article, which says that Jim Key had been hospitalized and then had to resign, and they don't have it caught up to where Jim died last week. And he was the moderator, the person who runs the business meeting, the person that we put our trust into for running things well. Our intention is to model a collaborative leadership that is reflected in the co-president structure, grounded in the faith that it is only together that real movement toward the beloved community is possible. At the beginning of our service, we can speak only to our hopes. We have been charged to call upon Unitarian Universalism to redeem its history by planning for and taking the steps toward living into an anti-racist, multicultural future. We are committed to making this a time of opportunity and not merely a troubled time to be survived. That's the core sentence. We are committed to making this a time of opportunity and not merely a troubled time to be survived. We have been charged to put in place a process of analysis of where we are on our journey toward wholeness. We have been committed to that journey for decades. The current challenges were prompted by the hiring process of UUA staff. We will certainly deal with policies and practices at the staff level. Two of our first actions were to call for a modified hiring freeze until we can be confident in our policies, and the addition of two outstanding staff members, both persons of color, to the leadership council. But we know that the real challenge is not only to model the world we dream about among the staff, but in our congregational life, and in the life of the many other institutions that together make up our faith. We will be calling for collective processes of discernment and commitment to move to the next stage of this journey. That stage will be to bring the experience and the leadership of persons of color into the center of our faith. That stage will be to help us all understand how Unitarian Universalism swims in the water of our culture's white supremacy. That stage will be to help all of us understand how Unitarian Universalism swims in the water of our culture's white supremacy. The building of the beloved community involves healing the world, but it also involves healing the brokenness in our community. This work will require relinquishing any notion of our innocence. This work will require relinquishing any notion of our innocence and understanding more deeply how we participate in the shortcomings of our culture. There will be progress, we hope, to report at General Assembly, but that process will be only at its beginning. We hope that our new president, elected in New Orleans, can view our work as a foundation. Some of the truth-telling and some of the healing will have been begun. Some confidence will have been reestablished. We hope that our new president can begin not only with a commitment to move toward the beloved community, but with some hope grounded in the initial work we will together set in motion. Bill Sinkford also said, Bill is a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, and he said, "I hope you can take away from my presence that we can not only survive this period, but thrive in it and through it if we are willing." That's what he told the staff. Beloved community was a phrase used in that many times. So what is the beloved community? According to the King Center, for Dr. King, the beloved community was not a lofty utopian goal to be confused with the rapturous image of the peaceable kingdom in which lions and lambs coexist in idyllic harmony. Rather, the beloved community was for him a realistic, achievable goal that could be attained by a critical mass of people committed to, and he said, and trained in the philosophy and methods of nonviolence, but I would also say committed to the beloved community. Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred. Peace with justice will prevail over war and military conflict. Dr. King said there's another element that must be present in our struggle that then makes our resistance and nonviolence truly meaningful. That element, he said, is reconciliation. Our ultimate end must be creation of the beloved community. He said that here in North Carolina, in Raleigh, in 1960. I thought it was great timing where whatever young voice is over there, I said, in the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. And there was a voice over there that said, uh-oh. So Martin Luther King Jr. envisioned a beloved community of love and justice where the races would be reconciled, the deep and terrible wounds of racism finally healed. Our ultimate goal, he said, is genuine intergroup and interpersonal living, integration. Physical desegregation is not enough, he said in the 60s, for it leaves us spiritually segregated where elbows are together and hearts apart. Dr. McKinley, we have an opportunity here. So, what is a beloved community? It's not just a phrase to be tossed off and thought it's just out there. It's something to be felt inside, not just to do, but that gives hope and meaning and connection. When we read the phrase, a vision of an earth made fair and all her people one, beloved community, if you play with words like I do at times, if you took beloved and you just put a line and separated be loved, it becomes the be loved community. Be loved, in which everyone can be loved. It could be the belonged community, which everyone belongs. And then if you take community and play with that, what does it say? So it's be loved in common unity. All of us together. Be loved, common unity. So be loved and loving. It's not a closed circle. There are many communities that make that work within a closed circle. In other words, like when I was 1970, I traveled, graduated from high school, VW bus in Florida with surfboards on the top, long hair. Actually, my daughter has put that picture on my cell phone so that my father took. But so, why are you laughing? So I, Central Florida, we head up to visit my relatives in South Georgia. And anyway, the point of the story is my aunt took me out to see my uncle in the field to, had cooked him lunch and was taking lunch out there. And he goes, Ellen, I thought you'd brought girls. And this was somebody that I had spent time with and thought loved me and all of this. And anyway, he couldn't handle it. but the point is, if you're inside that circle, there's nothing better. But if you're outside that circle, buddy, it feels like it's bad. And so I all of a sudden was outside that circle and had experienced that little bit. Well, that's what we're talking about, is being the beloved community, which is an open circle, a circle where we reach across and join hands, but we don't lock arms so that others are closed out. Beloved community, no closed circle, and it must be bigger than ourselves. The biblical vision of this inclusive vision of how it is to be in the world, we talked about last week in the title, Thanks Be to Good, that there is a good. We've just described the good. Let's get on with the good. But it could be caring for the poor. If you wanted to do a biblical understanding of it, biblical imperative, it could be caring for the poor, welcoming the stranger, protecting the earth, participating in Pride Parade next week. So, let's make this where it's not just an idea, but it's part of a bigger picture. Where does beloved community come from? It's not just a phrase. For those of you who have a biblical understanding, it comes from God. It comes from the love of God. But for me, it comes from how things are. And so if you just shift a little bit, God's there too. Or if you don't, you don't have to. But it's how things are, how the universe works or can be experienced. You've heard me do this before, but if you go from a big picture where we do kind of an orientation in our spiritual orientation, hearing class, start out with a picture from the Hubble telescope of this huge nebula, and it's a place where stars are born, where it's actually created. And then we come into the picture of our sun, so that's our star born somewhere. And then we come into the picture, the blue-green marble of Earth, and that's our home. And what is that? That's the place where the light, the energy from this big place star becomes us. We sort of wink in with that energy, life, it's us. And then given who we are, the question becomes, what are we supposed to do with it? What are we going to do with this opportunity? What does it mean to live well? What does it mean to be human? You know, what is the nature of existence? And then how are we to be together? Well, that's where groups of people provide answers to that. Not answers, but they said, we've lived with this understanding, and we say, yes, life is like that, and it's good. We call those faith traditions. The reason I'm doing that is to bring you down to the faith traditions of Unitarian and Universalism. Universalism had a loving God, all right? One human family, one nature, one origin, one destiny, one group, one beloved community to create. And you can say that's an inclusive universe. Unitarianism had an exalted view of human possibility. We can make that beloved community real if we just keep doing it and connecting it. And Jesus was one of the early exemplars, but as our understanding and vision of the world has gotten bigger, we realize there are many religious exemplars. So that was those two understandings and our faith traditions. They come down through history, and in 1961, they merged. Two streams that meet and merged, Unitarian and Universalism. But they didn't merge as faiths, really, or as, they just merged as associations, as a way of creating an institution, and it formed the Unitarian Universalist Association at that time. Well, I was ordained into this faith tradition in 1991. In 1961, that association, those traditions were mostly, we'd say, led by almost exclusively white men, straight white men. So it was an institution created by, and therefore for, in many ways, me. Okay? By the time I was ordained in 1991, a majority of the Unitarian Universalist ministers were then, had women. Okay. Mostly white women, but women. And then there was, in that, within that, there was the mix and the struggle where more and more were actually ministers that identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, questioning, transgender, whatever, in that as well. So, but here's what Bill Singford, who is the president of the UUA, said in a quote. He said that we've gone from a handful of women ministers in 40 years, we've gone from a handful of women ministers to a majority of women ministers. He said in that same time frame, we've gone from a handful of ministers of color to a handful of ministers of color. That's a good way to put it. We have an opportunity here. So what is the opportunity? Well, the opportunity is to look at what's happening now and really own that what we've done is not good enough. When we react to the fact that people's patience has run out, and we tend to jump into, I wish they wouldn't use those words, or if they just think this way or that way, we can step back from it and realize patience has run out. The journey toward wholeness has not led towards that wholeness that we seek. The gradual approach has not worked. So we have an opportunity to do differently, to be, as we've said, transformative and not just transactional, not just do fixes, but to be transformative. And what that requires is we have to be willing to be changed. We have to step back from that. I can tell you that I'm going to General Assembly and I'm going to the UUMA, Ministers Association meetings, and I've had to work on, I'm going to have to step back from my understandings of participation, not that I don't participate, but I have had these understandings created because of my upbringing as a white male in a white culture, white-dominated culture. So I'm going to have to step back and really think about how do I participate? What has integrity and need here, and where's my voice work? We have to be willing to be changed. Make the beloved community real. This is where it gets real, and we'll see. Another phrase from the reading, what was the one phrase that stood out in that reading that you heard that jumped at you, and you went, oof, like this? I can tell you. It was white supremacy. Our culture's white supremacy. That's where we get reactive, defensive. You go, hey, I've just worked where I can begin to hear white privilege, you know? Well, then you throw this at me. Here's the definition that is being used, and I'll explain it a little bit. They say, why white supremacy as the term here? And this is from materials that actually had a white supremacy teach-in that 600 congregations got signed up for So you would be sitting here having a white supremacy teach-in at this moment. But here's why it says, why do we use white supremacy? It conjures up images of hoods and mobs. Here we mean white supremacy as a set of institutional assumptions and practices, often operating unconsciously, that tend to benefit white people and exclude people of color. A set of institutional assumptions and practices, often operating unconsciously, that tend to benefit white people and exclude people of color. In 2017, actual white supremacists are not required in order to uphold white supremacist culture. Building a faith full of people who understand that key distinction is essential as we work toward a more just society in difficult political times. Build a beloved community where we are and where we live, and hearing our own struggles is what we have to do. In our classes on race matters, and in the last two classes we just finished last week, we addressed these terms, but also the situation in the UUA. And what I'd like to say to you real quickly is that we all have racial prejudice. Everybody does. But racial prejudice aligned with power, that's the power to do something and act on that racial prejudice, is what they use as a definition of racism. Okay? That you can't be racist if you don't have the power to impose your prejudice on the culture. And then the white privilege is the result of living in a culture where our institutions were built by white people for white people. I can see the wheels turning. And then it even goes back to connecting to an economy that grew on slavery. So white privilege and then white supremacy becomes that fact of what happens, in that when white privilege is institutionalized, I have supremacy over some person of color in when I'm being hired, or you can call it privilege, whatever you want. And then you get into those, but you don't have to get into the difficulties of the term. You just step back and go, oh yeah, I get this. I don't have to be defensive. I can work into this opportunity and work with it. So remember too, when I did the big picture, that with all this going on, we are an association of congregations. And when people talk about it, that's what's happening within that. It's not the bigger picture of faith. The faith is what? That beloved community is real, that it actually can be, and that we can make it happen. So this is an opportunity to try to do that work. One of the things they also says is that discomfort, we have to remember, is the root of all growth and learning. And the charge is to welcome it as much as you can. You go, yeah, right, Jim. I don't want to do that. But that's a piece of it. And I'm in it right now. So, all right. Yeah. I was going to ask for questions, but what does the average guy in the street do with all this? The average guy in the street, I don't know. What I've done with it is I keep asking myself questions of how I make the connections that, and I was going to tell you one of those, but how I keep making the connections that do this. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. One thing we did in this congregation is last Thursday, we met, turning conflict into community. 40 people sat in this sanctuary, knee to knee, and of different political persuasions and shared their stories. Shared, this is where I'm going with an answer to this, Bill, is they shared what are the formative events in your life that have created your values. Strangers sat and talked and shared, okay? Then, after they'd done that, back and forth, they turned and said, okay, how did those moments, how did those values inform what you're doing now? Okay, how you made your choices. Everybody in there heard the other person's story. And they went away, many of them, with their phone numbers and addresses to be in conversation later on. Okay, but think what happened there. They weren't in the issue of, I'm going to argue about this. All right, what were they doing? Their stories. What were their stories? They're about how they're living in relation to the universe. Right? They were actually sharing the common good. If you think about that, where the particular policies and arguments of that are not that. Those are layers on the experience of our lives. And I saw that for the first time. So come back. You keep coming back to this congregation in this town, in our town. This is where we are. And I know some of you hear this. Oh, and another example is we're in the part of the sanctuary working group right now. What does it mean to be sanctuary for a person who is going to be deported? And I thought, okay, maybe we've got some time as to how to do this and how to engage. And now Karen comes up this morning and we realize there's a person in our community who needs us to have already done that work so that we can offer them something. Around that, and we haven't finished it yet. How do we be transformative in this situation? How can we be willing to be changed? And the other thing I say to all of you is that many of you have said to me, Jim, I don't want to do anything anymore. I'm ready to not do. You know, there's these callings to do these things. I'm ready to not do. Your presence here today is a do. It's an action. Being a part, that's why we called it Make the Beloved Community Real. Being a part of it is a very, very powerful contribution for everybody who is here and everybody who participates in doing this work. So take that on and know that you're doing your part. The title of that workshop last Thursday was From Conflict to Community. It was an extension. We've done 8 subject on the subject of race meetings to this point. We're right where we need to be in relation to step in to this opportunity. When I was working on the log cabin crew, I had to learn how to use a draw knife before I could peel logs, you know, even just as simple as that. I had to get a tool belt. I didn't have a tool belt. I had to get warm clothes. Anyway, we can go on and on. But to be called and to step into the opportunity, we've been doing that work. And Bill gave the perfect segue into what we can do. This congregation is set up, and I think it's set up, and what we need to address more and more is we are set up to create what? Opportunity. We focus on the doing and the transaction, but we are set up to create opportunities for that action to be done, for us to be transformed, for the community to be transformed, and for us to have hope that we can make a difference. Is that a good segue to where you want to? Okay. And Helen's got to say something.
Jim's right.
Hang on. Let me be sure they can hear you. There you go.
Thank you. Jim's right. By being here this morning, you're already doing. And many of you go from here out there into the larger community, and you take yourself with you. What we're asking of you is that you take all of you, the ways in which you learned to be, for the most part, white, in positions of power, where you have the ability to create what you want for people who look like us, because I identify as white as well. We are part of this beloved community as we go out from here. So in terms of what can we do, we can take all of ourselves out of this room with the help of a particular group in this congregation, which is the Social Justice Outreach Team. SJOT, which is what most people call it, is the group of people in this congregation who go from these doors out into the doors of the larger community. And that is directly related to our faith community through a reading which in the back of your hymnal is either 471 or 473. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its prayer. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in fellowship, and to help one another. Susan Grider and I learned that covenantal statement as members of First Unitarian Universalist Congregation in San Diego, which is how they began all their services. And when I moved to Chicago as the district executive for Central Midwest District, I learned that a Unitarian named James Viola Blake wrote that statement for the congregation in Evanston as he was helping to spread Unitarian Universalist concepts throughout the Midwest through the Midwest Conference in the 19th century. We brought that here with us when we came to Hendersonville, the understanding that whatever we do as members of this fellowship, we are in covenant, covenant with you, covenant with our minister, our staff, covenant with each other and with this community. We helped, as part of that, through a group called Love Welcomes All, when the congregations, progressive congregations in the community, weren't really sure what that meant. What do you mean, love welcomes all? Well, it meant that love welcomed Susan and me together until the state allowed us to marry. So it was a huge transformational step for this congregation to say, we're a welcoming congregation, and to keep that up right through the time when we were granted the same civil rights that most of you have had since you were born. But we didn't. And those among us who are gay and lesbian, bisexual, queer, questioning, transgender people still lack many of the basic civil rights that you take for granted. So that's the knowledge you take out into the community with you. It put me in a room at St. James Episcopal Church one day when the director of the Boys and Girls Club here in Hendersonville said, listen, I think you don't know, because you're privileged to know where your next meal's coming from. He said, I've got children who eat lunch at school on Friday, and they eat again at school on Monday. Their families can't afford to put food in their stomachs over the weekend. He said, I cannot believe that the congregations, the faith communities in this town, can't get organized enough to provide something for those children between Friday lunchtime and Monday breakfast. And we said, actually, we think we can do that. It doesn't need a lot of talking and figuring out. It needs a commitment from us to feed those kids. And that's how the Feed the Kids program got started. It was started in conjunction with the backpack program, which sends kids home with a bag of food for their families over the weekend. And what it required, beyond organizing ourselves and putting a board together, on which many of members of this congregation still serve. A lot of people from this congregation are still cooking for those kids on Friday afternoon and taking a hot meal over to the Boys and Girls Club to feed whoever shows up. We don't ask questions about what their families are like or why they can't provide for the children they have. We just cook and we feed those kids. And a lot of us are still involved with that. And now we need to take along with our ability to cook and serve food an understanding of who we are as white people in this white community, for the most part, serving kids who are, for the most part, members of minority communities. And so we need to think again, not organize again, but think again about how we're representing ourselves and how we represent them. So we get together, we plan recipes, we figure out what we're going to do to just this little part of the community. It's not a huge effort, but there are a lot of other efforts that are bigger. We take the work of our hands and the commitment of our hearts together as we serve those children. And it's why I continue to support Feed the Kids still today, and it's why I put a big check in the contribution for youth hunger, because I grew up in a family that had food security. I had a lot of problems in my family, but food wasn't one of them. My mother loved to cook, and she could not stand the thought of a hungry child, and she taught me that I can't stand it either. Whatever needs to happen in this community to make sure that those kids get fed, I'll do it. That's one of my commitments. Yours are all over the place, but Feed the Kids is one of the ones that touched me. And what we want to do, what the Social Justice Outreach Team is working on, is developing a directory so you can find out easily who the contact person is, come talk to me or others in the congregation if that's the program that speaks to you. We want to put a directory of meaning together, and that's going to require some information from you about where you volunteer. Now, last week, the choir had its annual potluck, and because I knew this was coming up, I asked choir members where they volunteered. So it was just, you know, the people in the choir and their special people who are with them. And in a five-minute period, I found out that we've got people involved with Habitat for Humanity, one of whom couldn't attend the potluck because he'd built a house that day, and he was so bunged up with hammer and nails into a house frame that he couldn't attend the potluck. So we've got Habitat for Humanity, we have the Interfaith Assistance Ministry, Safe Flight, which used to be called Mainstay, the Free Clinics, Atkinson Elementary School, about two blocks from here, the Carl Sandburg House, the Backpack Program, Western Carolina Community Action, Feed the Kids. That's just what five choir members do in their spare time. You all do other things, and we want to find out what those things are. So downstairs today, if you go over to the SJOT corner, you'll find a way to tell the SJOT volunteer who's down there, and I think that it's going to be Charlotte, I think, and Carol will be there as well. So those are your contact people for this start. This is just the beginning. This is going to go on long enough to collect the information we need, put the directory together, put something on the website, acknowledge that we have Volunteers of the Month in this congregation. Some places a Volunteer of the Year that we want to acknowledge. We hope you'll help us, because all of this has to do with love as the spirit of this congregation and service as its prayer. So if you want to know more about that great covenant, the one that binds us together, then you can read on the website of the UUA a sermon called Bound in Covenant by a UU minister whose name is Victoria Safford. You can also read the UU World that just came recently for a lot of information about what we need to do. The region where the hiring decision went haywire is ours. That's the Southeast region. We don't have a lead person right now because things got messed up, and it's up to us to be part of the solution. This is our opportunity, and it's right here on our doorsteps. So we have to take that opportunity. For the words of James Vila Blake, you can refer to 471 or 473 in the hymnal. For words that were written in 1894 and still stand today, all these years later, I hope that you will think SJOT is doing a really good thing. Go downstairs after the service, find out what you can do to tell us what you're doing to volunteer, and then I also hope that you'll stay to participate in the conversation about General Assembly.